There's a lot of information in the scientific literature about the damaging effects of livestock on public lands. Why did you choose the approach you did in this book rather than a compilation and summary of the damage that livestock do to the public domain?
Well, Gary, there's actually a couple of ways I can answer that. My short answer is that after Lynn Jacobs' book, Waste of the West, and Werthner and Madison's book, Welfare Ranching, what was there left to write about? It's only about 5 years now since Welfare Ranching came out. I don't know that there's enough new material to actually constitute a full-length book. But there's a more fundamental answer as well, and that is that my book, Western Turf Wars, actually has the form that it does because I didn't set out to write a book. I actually set out to produce a collection of internet videos. And that's a notion and a project that goes back really to about 1998. That came about a year or so after I first started investigating problems with grazing in the West. I'd started out in 1997, and I had met through my travels several retired people from the government agencies, also grassroots activists. And based on those experiences, I thought it would be worthwhile to videotape these people speaking about the same issues that they'd discussed with me. So then by 1998, I thought maybe we could do this. Well, one problem was I didn't have any video equipment, and I didn't want to spend the money for it. Well, I had a friend, Jane Baxter, actually, who ran an organization called Range Watch, who did have video equipment and was using it to document grazing problems in the Sierra. But she had a completely different mindset about what she was using this video equipment for. She was going after local problems that were being focused on by local environmental organizations, and she would be able to go into these places, videotape them, get the tape edited and in a form that could be put onto a local TV station. So she was thinking locally and strategically, where I was thinking really nationally and kind of in a long-term way of altering public perception and knowledge about grazing on public lands. And also back in 1998, there wasn't a good way to distribute videos. We would have had to find some way to advertise these, and then the question is who would buy them. So we just kind of dropped the whole project, and then it wasn't until about 4 years later, in late 2002, that I began to think that these videos could be distributed over the internet, because high-speed internet service was becoming more common, and I thought, well, gee, I don't have to worry about selling these videos. I can just get funding for producing them and then install them on the internet and give them away. And the other thing that had been wearing on my mind during these years is that some of the people who I wanted to interview were dying. Denzel Ferguson, for instance, who wrote Sacred Cows at the Public Trough, had died in late 1998. And Joy Belsky, who was a good friend of mine, who was an ecologist for the Oregon Natural Desert Association, had died just in late 2001. And I had a couple of other friends who also were sick. Harold Winiger, who had been with Oregon Fish and Game, and Ray Corning, who was a hydrologist. He had contracted esophageal cancer. And these were guys that I wanted to interview, but they were really in very declining health. So by spring of 2003, I'd gotten some funding to buy video equipment and to underwrite the cost of my travel around the West, and I set out then in the summer of 2003 to do these interviews. And I did that for about 2 months, and then I came back here to the East, and I started looking at these things, and I thought, gee, there's a lot of material in these videos that really isn't suitable for display on the internet, but there's a lot of material in the interviews that could be organized more effectively into a book. And that's really when I first started thinking about this as a book. Problem, though, was that I didn't have enough breadth in the expertise of the people that I had interviewed in my opinion, for a book. And so that then necessitated my returning to the West in 2004 to conduct several more interviews, and then came back here and spent 34 months editing all of that into what became Western Turf Wars. And also during that time, I would take a week or two out now and then and produce another internet video. So eventually I've got something now like 29 short videos out on the internet. And so that's basically how the book came to be. As I said, it started out to be a video project that then kind of morphed into a book.
Well, that's great that you've been able to do both. I think, Mike, one of the things that would interest the people in this part of the world would be, of course, your website. And so I'm going to ask you to give it now, but also at the end of the program, so people know where they can order a copy of the book and or also see some of these videos that you've produced.
Well, there are two websites. There's a personal website that also contains information about my nonprofit organization, and the videos are linked off of that website, and that website is MikeHudak.com. And then there's another website just for the book, and that website is WesternTurfWars.com, and there's information on that website for purchasing the book directly through the website. There's also my address and phone number, so people can contact me if they don't want to purchase the book through the website.
Great. So there's a lot of variety of outlets there to purchase this book, and I would encourage the listeners, if they are interested, to visit those websites and to contact you, Mike. One of the things that impressed me about the book was your mentioning of one of the great writers in America, and that's Studs Terkel. Can you explain that? And this is sort of a follow-up to my first question of why did you do a book about the social effects of grazing as much as the environmental effects?
Well, as I said, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of people during my travels, beginning in 1997, but continuing in 98 and 99. And these were people who were retirees of the federal and even some state agencies, the state wildlife agencies, and many grassroots activists. And I not only talked with these people, but in many cases they actually took me out to allotments, grazing allotments in their local area that they were familiar with. Some of these were allotments that they had worked on during their careers. And so they gave me a lot of expert information about these places. And that had a very powerful effect on the way I thought about all of this. And of course, these people also told me some of their personal stories about their careers, problems that they had encountered within the agencies where they had attempted to obtain better management of these lands and the kind of political and social pressure that they had been subjected to as a result of their efforts. And I thought that if the American people could hear those stories, not just retold by me, but actually see these people telling these stories in my videos and then reading their own words in a book, that would really have much more of an impression than simply reading the results of scientific studies, which were already out there to be read in books like Waste of the West and Welfare Ranching anyway. So I wanted to add this personal dimension to the whole issue that I thought was lacking. And certainly I think the ranchers have held sway in the personal touch for decades anyway, through the entertainment media and advertising and so on. And so I thought we needed kind of a view of ranching from a conservationist perspective, and that the retirees from these federal agencies and also the local grassroots activists who had worked on these environmental issues were the people who could best make that case.
Well, Mike, that leads actually to my next question for you. Some people have asserted there is a myth of the cowboy in American culture, and that makes it difficult to question public land ranching. What are your thoughts on this question, this topic?
Well, I tend to agree with that view. I would say, though, from at least what I've read about it, that the cowboy myth is somewhat less influential now than it was, let's say, even 35 years ago. But it's certainly not dead. And I'll just tell you a little bit about what I've learned in doing the work for my book and in shows that I'm doing about the book now. And that is that the cowboy myth can really be traced back to the late 19th century, particularly to the Buffalo Bill Wild West shows that started in the early 1880s. And Bill Cody incorporated a cowboy act into that show. It got a lot of notoriety, really made a superstar out of the person who played that role. And then a lot of magazine and dime novel writers picked this up. They realized that this was something that a lot of people were interested in. And so there were a lot of fictional stories written about cowboys throughout the 1880s and 1890s. And there was kind of a common theme in these stories, at least in regards to the character of the cowboy. The cowboys were generally all portrayed in very positive light. They all had great virtues of things like honesty and courage, industriousness, intelligence, certainly had great fighting skills in terms of their gunfighting abilities. They were patriots. They showed respect to women, kindness to animals, and so on. And some of the stories even went beyond that kind of portrayal to show the cowboys as kind of supermen. I've seen stories, for instance, where a cowboy would successfully wrestle a grizzly bear. Or I've seen an early Tom Mix film from the 1920s where Tom Mix is riding a horse, presumably riding a horse, and jumping over a chasm that no horse could jump over. And of course it was done with trick photography, but I suspect that the kids who were watching that film back in the 1920s probably thought it was actually being done. So we have these very positive portrayals of cowboys combined with a superhuman status, which was later then really taken on by real superheroes. In the comic books of the 1930s and 40s, we see people like Superman and Batman and Spider-Man and so on coming up. Well, these were explicit superheroes, whereas the cowboy of earlier decades was kind of an implicit superhero. But again, this all contributed to this persona of the cowboy as super virtuous and superhuman. And then as the entertainment industry expanded through talking pictures in the 1920s and radio shows, then the cowboy expanded into those media as well. And of course, with the availability of sound, now we have the cowboy ability to take on another role, and that of being a troubadour. And so we see the singing cowboy with people like Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and other people in the 1930s. And then, of course, with the invention of television in the 1950s, we see then these cowboys moving there as well. And that was a very important development because something happened then in the 1950s that fundamentally changed the portrayal of cowboys. Up to that point, in virtually all of these media, the cowboy was targeted primarily at young males. It's not entirely true. There certainly were film westerns made, people like John Wayne and so on, that were not targeted at children but were for adults. But the vast majority of these films up through the 1950s were intended for children. In early 1950s, a radio show came on called Gunsmoke, and this was the first Western drama targeted at adults. And then a few years later, a TV version of that appeared, which stayed on national television for 20 years. So that then was a fundamental change. Basically, you had kids who had grown up on cowboy westerns in the 1930s and 40s who were now adults, and American advertisers realized that they could now market the cowboy to those adults and make a lot of money. What happened then, though, is that the rise of television in general caused a considerable decline in movie attendance, and the prevalence of television westerns pretty much killed off the cinematic Western. That not only did the cinematic Western decline in number, but it declined in percentage of the type of films that were made throughout the 1950s through the 1970s. So by the time you get into the mid-1970s, there aren't that many film Westerns being made anymore. And also, the societal interest in the Western in general throughout the 1960s had declined as well. So that by the mid-70s, the Western as a genre was pretty much dead. And some of the things I've read as to why this happened include things like the Vietnam War, for instance, which caused a lot of questioning of authority figures, particularly in government, particularly among the police. So if someone is turning on their national news in the 1960s and they're seeing riots in the streets with the police brutalizing students, and then you turn on Gunsmoke in the evening and you see Marshall Dillon, the virtuous law enforcement officer, maintaining peace in Dodge City, there's a little bit of dissonance there. And then there were other social movements that were going on through the 1960s as well that tended to undermine the Western genre. Among these, things like the women's movement, the Native American movement, the Asian American movement, all of these groups had been stereotyped in the traditional Western, and with these gender and ethnic groups now wanting greater respect, it was difficult to write a traditional Western by the end of the 1960s that didn't offend somebody. And so basically, the whole genre was just defunct. And after the mid-1970s, there was not enough interest nationally to sustain a television Western beyond a single season, hardly. And although there have been a few attempts since then, nothing has survived. So it suggests to me that at a national level, the cowboy myth is much diminished from what it was, as I said, in even as recently as the mid-1970s. It's not to say that the cowboy myth is dead. I'm sure that it still persists in the West to a considerable extent because, of course, the ranchers are right there, and they're in positions of power. They're the elected officials, they're judges, and so on. But outside of the West, you don't have people in Connecticut anymore who are watching an average of 2.5 hours of Westerns on TV every night of the week anymore. It's just not there. So you don't have that kind of constant indoctrination into the cowboy myth that we had 30 or 40 years ago. So that's pretty much where I think we are today with that. There's still some influence. I was just lobbying in Washington a few weeks ago, and I was talking with a fellow environmental activist who said, yeah, but geez, there's so many people in the Congress who are still supporters of ranching. And I said, well, of course, if they're from the West, that's pretty much understandable since we have a privately funded election system here. But for people outside of the West, elected officials outside of the West, well, who are these people? If they're males and they're at least 55 years of age or so, well, then they probably grew up still watching those television shows back in the 1950s and 60s as I did. But as younger people come into the Congress, you're going to see, I think, much less infatuation and indoctrination into the cowboy myth simply because it was not available in the mainstream media to those people in their childhood.
Okay, well, I think that's a great summary of the topic we're talking about today and the sort of social background, the milieu, if you will, of what we're facing on the public lands today in terms of livestock grazing. You've talked a little bit about some of the people that you interviewed, but could you expand on that? How did you decide to interview the people that you did decide to interview?
Well, of course, I wanted to look at where the conflict over the management of ranching takes place. And from my experience, as I said, traveling around the West in the late 1990s, I came to understand that that conflict takes place inside these federal agencies, the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And so I interviewed people who were retired from those agencies, who had long careers in those agencies, or had careers in the state wildlife agencies. And there's some actual interesting politics that can go on between the state wildlife agencies and the federal agencies as well. Some of that comes out in my book. And then to broaden the perspective, I also interviewed grassroots activists who had long experience dealing with the federal agencies. So it's not quite a 50-50 split. I think there were 15 people I interviewed from the agencies and 12 people who I would call citizen conservation advocates. And I actually had interviewed more than that. Altogether, there were about 40 people I interviewed. But I also put this book together and edited it. And I didn't want a book that was too long. If you look at a lot of books today that are written dealing with politics or history, you'll see they're typically 320 to 340 pages in length. Occasionally, you'll get one that's much longer, but they seem to be typically now 320 to 340, 350. And even with the 27 people in there, the book came out to more than 400 pages. And so I didn't want a book that would be too costly to produce for what I could sell it for. And so I had to limit it. But I have been now putting up some of the additional interviews onto the book's website. I'm calling these extra canonical books. And I really consider each of these interviews as an independent book, and that the entire work, Western Turf Wars, is really a collection of books. So I've already got two of these interviews up there on the book's website. One of them I just put up a couple of days ago. But getting back to your original question, I did want a wide range of people who had technical experience particularly. So I've got people from these agencies who were biologists of various sorts, fisheries biologists, big game biologists. I've got a botanist, several range conservationists, and then managers of various sorts, from district ranger all the way up to regional supervisor. And so it's quite a wide variety of people.
I thought the variety was very broad and also very telling, and it was a story that hadn't been told before, and that is one of the things that really impressed me about the book. The agency and former agency people you interviewed had some very powerful stories to tell. Were there any common themes you found in the interviews you did with those people?
There were some, and of course these are generalizations, and they might be contradicted in specific instances, but one theme that does stick with me from several of the people is that the agencies seem to avoid obtaining data about the condition of land under their management. Now, we always hear that the agencies are underfunded and understaffed, and so that's kind of their general excuse as to why they can't do proper monitoring or proper inventory. But what I'm hearing from people is that the agencies are really avoiding collecting the data, even when they can do it. And I can give you a couple examples of these stories. One of them was told to me by a botanist, Rene Galliano Pop, who had worked on the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest in Arizona back in the 80s. And she said that the Nature Conservancy had approached her supervisor requesting that she go out onto the forest and look for a plant species or two that was rare. I don't know whether it had been federally listed. It perhaps had been. And she said that her supervisor just made excuse one after the other as to why she didn't have time or otherwise wasn't able to go out there and look for this plant. And certainly her impression, and this was conveyed quite clearly in her interview with me, that her supervisor just didn't want to know that this plant was out in the forest. Presumably, if it was there, it could have interfered with their logging plans or maybe with grazing. Another example I could give was one told to me by Bill Worf, who was a regional supervisor. In other positions in his career, he'd been a forest supervisor and other things. He actually formed a environmental organization after he retired called Wilderness Watch, and it was through that he gained additional experience about what was going on these public lands. And so he told me a story about the Modoc National Forest in Northern California, where he learned that there had been some range studies done back in the 1930s. And he wanted to see those studies to compare with studies that had been done then in the 1990s. And so he approached the district ranger about this, and he said she made it very clear that she was not interested in those old studies. They had progressed very much in the way they did studies of that sort. Nothing could be gained by looking at them and so on. And of course, he disagreed with that. He'd been involved in doing range studies himself since the 1950s, and he thought that looking at these old studies from 60 years before would really give the agency some perspective on how well their management had been doing over that period. And he also felt that this was a case where the Forest Service management just didn't want to know what those old studies had shown. So that's one major theme that comes through. Another that sort of ties into that is the feeling that sustainable multiple-use management is a sham. As one of my interviewees said, if there's forage out there, you've got to graze it. If there's timber, you've got to cut it, and so on. And, of course, with this lack of monitoring, it's pretty easy then to get away with overusing these resources without anyone being able to prove that the overall resource is being degraded. And so that kind of stuff, it seems, can go on for decades then without anybody really knowing. And there certainly is some indication from remarks people made, anecdotal remarks, that the overall condition in some of these places, such as on the Modoc National Forest and perhaps in places in Utah, that there really is a long-term downward trend which is not being picked up by any monitoring.
The earnestness at which these stories were relayed in your book really comes through. And do you think that the agency and former agency people felt that your book was the one chance they had to relay their message to the public? In other words, why wasn't their story told in the past, or why hasn't it been told, in your opinion?
Well, the situation is mixed across the people I interviewed. I'd say some of the people that I interviewed felt that way, that their story hadn't been told, and that talking to me was a great opportunity. Probably the one person who comes across strongest in that way is someone who I didn't even know about until I interviewed Renee Galliano Pop, who I interviewed early during my travels in 2004. And she was a friend of this guy, Patrick Ward. And so Renee and I did the interview, and then she said, gee, you know, I know this guy down in southern New Mexico that you ought to get in touch with. I bet he'd like to tell you about what he's doing. And so, yeah, I did contact him. At that time, I didn't even know that he was still employed by the agency that he wanted to talk to me about. And I didn't actually know that until I arrived there to conduct the interview a couple of months later. Then I really tried to talk him out of doing the interview. We went out to dinner, and I said, geez, you sure you really want to do this? Maybe this isn't going to be so good for your career. And he said, no, I really want to do it. And so we did the interview, and then it turned out about a year later, he actually did get kicked out of his job. The funding for his position was eliminated, and he was gone. My cynical interpretation is that he was probably learning in his research things that the Forest Service didn't want to know. And so they found it convenient to get his funding cut off. That's what I suspect. He was researching the effects of cattle grazing on the prey base of the Mexican spotted owl. And basically he was concluding that the level of grazing that was being conducted on the Lincoln National Forest was so great that these prey populations, deer, mice, and voles, were being wiped out and that it was interfering with the reproductive ability of the Mexican spotted owl. So yeah, Patrick Ward wanted to talk with me really bad, even when it seemed to run counter to his best interests in his career. But he's doing okay now. He's working for another agency. But some of the people that I spoke with actually had some notoriety in the press. Steve Johnson and Don Oman had been interviewed in the early 90s by Sharman Apt Russell for her book, Kill the Cowboy. And that came out in 1993. But she didn't give them the extensive opportunity to tell their stories in the way I did. Her book is much more conventionally written than mine. So she basically had a narrative with just selected quotes by these people, and it's all woven together. And then a few other people had gotten notoriety for specific things, like Leon Fager and Rene Galliano Pop and a few other people back in 1998 resigned from the Forest Service in protest for some things that were happening in the Southwest region. So they got some play in the press at that time. It didn't last long, but there were stories about it. And then there were some other people, Martha Hahn, who was a Clinton-era appointee to be the BLM's director in Idaho, was forced out of the BLM in 2002, I believe. And so that story had gotten some play in the press also. In fact, she was even on PBS's Now show with Bill Moyers back then. So it's not like all of the people had never received any attention, but they didn't receive as much as they got in my book and on the videos that I've done with them.
I want to shift gears here a little bit and just make a quick comment. I happen to know a couple of the people that you interviewed fairly well. Martha Hahn, I dealt with her back in the late 70s, early 80s in Utah. And Bill Wharf, I've known since, I think, the early 80s, and I think the world of him. So I was very happy to see them included in your book. I'm going to shift gears here to some of the citizen activists or citizens, including you had one indigenous person from one of the Native American tribes, one of the Indian tribes, I believe in the Black Hills area. Those people also had some very powerful stories. Did you find any common themes amongst citizens who were very concerned about the impacts of livestock grazing on the environment, treaty rights, and other important factors?
I think the most consistent theme there among these people is that there is a bias in the federal land management agencies, the Forest Service, and the BLM toward ranchers. I can give you a couple of examples that were told to me. Julian Hatch, who is an activist from southern Utah, told me a story about how there were some trespass cattle that had gotten into his private land. Now, he had it fenced. He had his land fenced off, but the fence had been cut and cattle had gotten in there. So he went down to the local BLM office and he complained about this. And they said, well, you know, it's your responsibility to keep those cattle fenced out of there. And he says, well, I do, but someone cut the fence. But then he also noticed that there was a sign on the wall giving the dates of grazing when these cattle were even supposed to be on the adjacent public lands. And that area was off limits to grazing at that time. The grazing season had passed. So not only were the cattle not supposed to be on his private land, they weren't even supposed to be on the public land that was adjacent to it. Well, okay, the BLM official said, yeah, we'll take care of this. We'll inform the rancher that he should get his cattle off of there. Well, then a short time later, Julian Hatch encounters the rancher's son in town. It's not much of a town. I've been there. This is Boulder, Utah. And Julian said that the rancher shot and killed his dog in retaliation for Julian reporting this rancher's cattle being in trespass. So why would the BLM, whose responsibility it was to enforce the grazing on the public land, why would they inform the rancher that it was particularly Julian Hatch who had reported the cattle being in trespass? It's not the rancher's business whether it was Julian Hatch or anyone else. And so the agency really made Julian a target for retaliation by the rancher. So I'd say that would be a pretty clear example of bias within the agency towards the rancher. There was another example that was told to me by Patrick Deal, who was actually a friend of Julian's. Patrick also lived in southern Utah, and he had a permit one time back in year 2000 to a table at the visitor center at the Grand Staircase National Monument. I guess Patrick believed that the permit did not specifically say where he could and could not table. He was distributing literature critical of grazing in the monument, and Patrick said that he had set up his table near the entrance of the visitor center, but not blocking anyone, not disturbing the land in any way. And an official from the BLM said no, he'd have to move to the distant end of the parking lot where visitors would not commonly encounter him. And Patrick refused, and Patrick was then arrested. So again, you get the idea that the agency was favoring ranchers by trying to prevent an activist from interacting with the public. And then there's another story that was told to me by Michael Sauber, who was an activist in southern New Mexico. He co-founded an organization called Gila Watch, and that organization worked to improve the conditions on the Gila National Forest. There had been some severe overgrazing, particularly in the Gila and Aldo Leopold wildernesses. This was back in the early 1990s. And there was some public documents that Mike and his partner, Susan Schock, wanted from the Forest Service, and they had been unable to obtain those documents. So Mike said that they had one time sent a college student to the Forest Service office instead of them going, and the college student asked for these documents. And the Forest Service employee, right in front of this student, said to another employee, "Oh, yeah, get those documents that we took out of the folder when Mike and Susan were here." So it was a deliberate attempt by the Forest Service employees to prevent environmental activists from seeing public documents that could have been viewed as being to the disadvantage of the rancher involved. Those are just three examples of rancher bias in the agencies. Another theme that comes through, and I've already alluded to this a little bit, and that is that there's oppression of activists in rural society in the West. And this manifests itself in various ways. It can be shunning, where neighbors won't talk to the people. People will not wait on them in stores. And it can also be more severe. There were stories that people told, well, like I mentioned already, with Julian Hatch having his dog shot and killed, and other people talked about having property damage inflicted on them. Patrick Deal had a situation where his property was flooded by having a water line opened and 40,000 gallons of water poured onto his property. He had also reported incidents of having windows in his house smashed and his tires slashed and so on. Death threats left on his answering machine. So this is the kind of environment that these activists have to live with constantly. So I'd say those are the two basic themes: oppression from one's neighbors and bias towards ranchers within the management agencies.
And they say that can't happen in America. Well, there you go. That is a problem, I think, across the West and in many places in this country. Ironically, there's a perception out there among some people that the citizens who are concerned about the fate of the planet, the environmentalists or citizen activists, if you will, already have considerable access to the media. Do you believe those that you interviewed felt that their message had been addressed, especially when it concerns the impacts of livestock on the public lands versus, say, you know, logging on public lands or some other issues affecting public lands?
Well, actually, there weren't too many of the people with whom I spoke who actually had a lot of experience with the media. There were a few people who had been involved in long-term campaigns, for instance, like Michael Sauber, who I mentioned, Patrick Deal. Patrick Deal and his partner, Tori Woodard, actually came to grazing activism with a long history in anti-nuclear activism, more than 20 years of experience doing that. So they had a lot of experience working with the news media, issuing press releases. And they also took the approach of not just dealing with the local media in the area where they were working. Let's say they were trying to prevent a nuclear waste dump or something someplace. Well, they didn't just work with the media there. They looked to the national media, the LA Times, the Salt Lake Tribune, the Denver Post, and so on. And so they had actually cultivated some relationships with reporters at those papers over the years in doing that other kind of activism. So when they moved to southern Utah in the late 1990s, they were able to bring some of that, not just expertise, but those media connections into that new area of activism. So they were actually fairly successful in getting the stories out, like I mentioned about Patrick Deal's arrest at the Grand Staircase Visitor Center, and then his incarceration, and he did a hunger strike in prison, and that got quite a bit of national coverage. But people like Mike Sauber, for instance, who were working with media at the local level, I think were not quite as successful. Mike Sauber told a story about dealing with the newspaper in Silver City, New Mexico, back in the mid-1990s. This must have been around 1994, I guess. Just to give a little bit of the context of the situation, there had been a drought. The Forest Service wanted to reduce the number of cattle on a major allotment in the Gila Wilderness, and several head of cattle had already died due to lack of vegetation or eating toxic vegetation. But the rancher really didn't want to move his cattle. Here the Forest Service was offering another allotment which had better forage on it. The rancher just had to move his cattle there, and he didn't want to do it. He says, well, the cattle are too weak. And I think he also had the feeling that if he moved his cattle off, that the Forest Service wouldn't allow him to move them back anyway. The rancher used his political connections through the governor, his U.S. representative, his federal senators, and they had a big powwow out on the allotment, and people examined the allotment for a couple of days. And during that time, Mike told me, and Mike Sauber was present at this, he said the rancher made a veiled threat to the Forest Service that if they attempted to move his cattle off of that allotment, that there'd be 100 people out there with guns to stop them from doing that. Okay, well, this whole thing ends up, fast forward a couple of weeks, the Forest Service comes out with another plan for managing the cattle. He no longer has to move 500 of his 600 cattle. He now only has to move a few hundred of them, 200, I guess, instead of moving 500. And the local newspaper writes this up as if the Forest Service is attempting to put this rancher out of business. And the article was very incomplete. It didn't say that originally they'd want him to move several hundred more cattle and so on. They never mentioned that the rancher had made these veiled threats against Forest Service employees and so on. And so Mike and Susan, as the leaders of Gila Watch, wanted to write a rebuttal letter to the editor, and the newspaper refused to print it. And Mike and Susan then offered to purchase ad space to write their rebuttal. And again, this was refused. So this is an example then of a definite bias in the news media against environmentalists. And at the time, there wasn't really any way for them to get around this. Nowadays, of course, an organization could have their own website and their own blog, and one could get that information out without relying on the mainstream news media. But this was, as I said, 1994, and those things weren't available.
Well, Mike, after doing these interviews, what changes in public land grazing policy do you suggest be adopted? Specifically, what changes do you believe should be done so that agency people and citizens don't feel threatened? And you've talked about some of these threats, including death threats, when doing their jobs or speaking out, you know, exercising their constitutional rights.
I actually don't think that there are any good solutions to the problem. And by good, I mean solutions that are actually likely to be implemented. There are a few things that can be done, certainly on an ad hoc basis. But many of the problems are systemic. They're built into our privately funded electoral system. They're built into the funding system of these agencies. And so I don't see really, I mean, I can make a few suggestions about these things. Certainly in the case of individuals who have to make difficult decisions about reducing grazing or eliminating grazing in places, one can find really tough individuals, preferably people who don't have families, who can be brought in for short periods of time to make these management decisions that will be very unpopular with the great majority of the rural population who are either ranchers or friends or relatives of ranchers. So that's one possibility. But then even those people need to have the support of their superiors, or else they're not going to be able to pull these things off. This kind of thing actually was done in the case of Heart Mountain National Antelope Refuge in southern Oregon during the early 1990s. They brought in a manager by the name of Barry Reiswig, who acted in much this way. He was there for 5 years, and then they moved him off to Montana or someplace. So that kind of thing can be done. But as far as the funding problems, where the agencies are funded annually and at the whim of Congress, unless there is some kind of maybe an oversight committee, sort of like the Government Accountability Office, that could actually look at these budgets and then flag anything that looks like it's been politically motivated. I don't see how you can prevent ranchers from influencing the forest or BLM managers by having a congressperson who's in the pocket of the rancher or the livestock industry in general. How do you prevent that politician from having a negative influence on the budget of a particular forest or BLM district? And so I don't see that there's an easy solution to that. And then also, just as long as we have privately funded election campaigns, how do you reduce the influence that the livestock or the timber industry or the mining industry, for that matter, is going to have on our elected officials? So I think you're going to have some publicly funded campaigns in order to get past that. So those are huge changes, and I don't see any of those coming along in the short term. I think the better chance for just better management lies in continuing litigation by the environmental organizations that we've seen for the last 15, 16 years, and also in buyouts of grazing allotments on a voluntary basis that are either privately funded or hopefully eventually will get legislation that will provide federal money to compensate ranchers who want to retire their allotments. And that's a whole other discussion as to why they would want to retire them, but certainly the litigation that we're seeing from the environmental organizations might be one reason. Also, just worsening economic conditions and climate, drought, and so on that could make ranching less profitable would also be motivating factors.
Well, it sounds like public lands for public purposes is the eventual answer, and public lands for sort of environmental purposes, rather than having them captured by private special interests. And that's a big long-term goal, I think, of many people in the conservation community. Mike, can you give us again the websites that people could visit to find out more about your book, Western Turf Wars? And I highly recommend it. It's an excellent book. It takes a very different approach. It's a very personal and heartfelt approach by people that have been affected by public land grazing, either from an agency perspective or just a citizen perspective. And where can they find out more about your book and how to purchase it?
Right. The book has its own website. The website name is the same as the book. It's westernturfwars.com.